Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it does seem that another Thursday night has come around, and again, unfortunately, I don't have anything to talk to you about. But I'll try to think of something as we go along. And I think it would be very good if I gave you one talk about nothing much, sort of a third dynamic sort of talk, and then I talk to you about the latest developments in processing in the last hour you might like to hear about. So I'll talk now about nothing much. And speaking of Eisenhower... the facts of the case today in the world give us a very new perspective on Scientology. Scientology has taken a very new role. It was the role it always had previously, but many people did not see enough emergency or need for anything to take that role, and so perhaps they did not view this role to the degree that they might have. As I say, the role has always been there. In Science of Survival, you read of a world without war, without crime, without insanity. That's very interesting. That was our hope, but something new has been added. And that is a governmental atomic program, which has as its end product a world without people. And this is something which then changes our view and changes our perspective. I don't like to back up the hearse. I leave that to the insurance business. They do very, very well at that. I recommended to an insurance man one time, you know, he comes in and he says to the widow, now supposing, the to-be widow, you see, supposing your husband died, there you would be with the house payments, all of the children's support, and no job and so on. Well, now here's a policy, sign on the dotted line. This was his favorite method of selling, you see. And he'd go around to some fellow, and supposing your wife died, there you'd have all these children left in your hands and all the expenses of the funeral and so forth and sign on the dotted line. So I was in his office one day and I heard him back up the hearse to one customer too many, as far as I was concerned. So I said, say, you know, why don't you hire one of these old horse-drawn hearses and just drive around town with your insurance address painted on the side of it? And he sat there for a long time, and finally he said, no, he said, I don't think I'll do that. He said, it would be too flashy. So that almost anything I say now, no matter how dreary, would in essence be much too flashy compared to the possible future of the human race. One has to be willing to confront a great many things in life in order to live it. And as he is willing to confront, so he is then willing to cope. If he can confront something, he can cope with it. If he's unwilling, or if he finds it impossible to confront something, why then he will not cope with it. And man today is in a state of having developed something it cannot confront. Atomic fission. It can't confront it. You go into a theater, they show the motion pictures of Bikini or something of the sort, and you will find people toward the rear will sneak out of their seats and will walk out into the lobby. You find other people will duck their heads. Interesting phenomenon. I had to study this phenomenon because I wanted to know whether or not it would do any good to release a manual on civil defense. And we found out that there was no point in it. Nobody would have read it. In other words, at that time, we were interested mainly in the dissemination of Scientology, and we wished civil defense to front for us a little bit on some of the things we could do. That was only 2 or 3 years ago. But we did not publish the manual. The manual was a very factual manual of material taken out of the technologies used by military governments in war-torn areas, a very realistic view of the situation. It isn't all going to be the way they say it's going to be in the civil defense, quote, manuals, unquote, which are issued by the government. These civil defense manuals of today start this way. You will have to get used to the idea that after the dropping of an atomic bomb, you will be on your own. There will be nobody to help you. Well, then, who's what they sitting there for? What is this thing? Oh, I get it. It's some sort of a racket by which you can collect some salary from the government before the bombs go off. Must be, because their manuals... Oh, no, you think I'm just kidding you now, drawing a long bow. I've had people tell me many times that they thought I was drawing a long bow and being very exaggerated, something of the sort. One chap who went over to Ireland told me this. He said, You know, all through my HCA course, I thought you were exaggerating things a little bit. But you know, the other day I looked up this fellow Wundt. And he said, that's impossible, but it's true. He said, I didn't think such a man existed. I just thought that was one of your jokes. Mr. Wundt did invent animal physical psychology in 1879 in Leipzig, Germany, and threw away all earlier psychologies. And this HCA student thought this was just my way of saying that it was kind of bad and we ought to do something about it. So when I'm saying that we laid aside the civil defense program, or when I say the civil defense program of the United States is not realistic, I'm actually not telling you a joke. And when I tell you that they start their civil defense manuals by saying, this is all very well up to the moment a bomb is dropped, but after that you're on your own, because nobody's going to help you. And if this is the basic primary statement of civil defense, it says at once that there isn't any. Because civil defense would be the prevention of ultimate disaster to a civil populace by reason of a bomb having dropped. This would be the only reason you'd have civil defense, you see. So if they say there's nobody going to help you, they say they aren't even there. Well, I read in this morning's paper about a multi-billion-dollar program. It was the most beautiful headline I ever saw. Boy, was it meaningful. I said, man, somebody's got on the ball here. Somebody's going to get in a pitch. Somebody's right there. A multi-billion-dollar program proposed by Ike, pardon me. I gave him the Russian pronunciation. And he says he's going to have shelters. They're going to have civil defense shelters built all over the country, and they've lately been taking all sorts of surveys amongst industrialists to find out if they had enough concrete and iron and reinforcing materials and so on to build these shelters. And Ike is going to ask the Congress for a multi-billion dollar bill or appropriation in order to start this air aid program. I thought it was the most wonderful thing, and I read down the line. Next year, it said, only a few million dollars would be expended, more or less piloting the project. Just how long it would take this project to get underway, of course, is a matter for future decision. But many government experts believe this, and many government experts believe that. An expert in what? What are these experts? Well, they must be experts in being unaware. Because if anybody is going to start on a civil defense shelter program that is only going to spend a few million dollars next year to find out how to build them, these boys aren't living in the world of today. I'm not saying the atomic war is going to happen at all. But I'm saying that from a government viewpoint, to leave a target wide open is to invite an attack. At no time when you're boxing do you ever, particularly in championship fights, drop your gloves to your sides and say, you see, I can't hit back, got a broken arm, you know? At that moment, your opponent says, no kidding, pow! See? So to leave a country wide open with no planning, no adequate status for the populace, if there is an enemy attack, is to ask the enemy to make an attack. The least they could do is to advertise the selection of another city as the second capital, the second command post. Instead of that, they're burrowing into the West Virginia hills. There's a government department here and a government department there. I was out on a long trail one day, and I came to a sort of dead end, And beyond that, there were a couple of foxholes and so forth, and it said defense area. I thought this is an interesting place to be until I realized that I was probably looking at a new government department. They're being scattered down the length and breadth of the Appalachians and probably up and down the Rockies. You will see, undoubtedly, within a few months, some senator present a bill to get an emergency Senate, possibly in a Senate and the House of Representatives, and he will propose that it be stashed away in Vermont or someplace. This government is not acting to provide itself with a second command post. It is dispersing. And we have enough trouble in Scientology trying to keep communication up between downtown and the distribution center out in Silver Spring to realize quite adequately that if you were to put the White House someplace around West Virginia, there's two or three towns down there that are very, very good places for the White House. One of them's Harlan County. Harlan County, that's a very good place. They shoot everybody. And you have the White House there, and the State Department is stashed up around Pittsburgh someplace, and then there's the Communications Office of the War Department is down in Georgia, and so on. This will then be a government? No, indeed. Couldn't possibly. There isn't enough communication centralization there in order to maintain its command of any given situation. Give you an example. Right this moment, a Secretary of State is in Key West. His second in command is in New York. There's an assistant to the assistant to the assistant down here, Herbert Hoover Jr., who is holding the fort in Washington. And British and French representatives have for some days been trying to get in touch with the State Department in order to discuss some solution to the strained relations. And they can't find anybody anyplace. The ambassador goes up to New York, but that fellow up there doesn't have any real authority, so the ambassador hasn't got time to go to Key West, so he comes into Washington thinking he'll talk to the president himself, but the president's in Georgia. This situation just occurred. The premier of Australia was just within the last 24 hours very grossly insulted by not being able to talk to the president and was forced to talk to a couple of clerks down here, and he went off in a huff, believe me. Now, there is an example of trying to do business on a dispersed basis. It's very difficult to do so, extremely difficult. Now, it would be difficult enough if you were doing business on a dispersed basis in some fairly only half-caved-in organization such as our own. See, we're eight times as good as any other human organization, and we're just shot to hell. And you get downstairs to a no-organization thing like the government, and how is it going to even vaguely govern if it's dispersed all over the country? In the first place, an atomic attack would then invite the government to do a dispersal and cease to be the government, instead of having a centralized command post somewhere else in the country, or two or three of such. In other words, that's an invitation to attack. They say, well, look, all we have to do is knock out Washington, and we will then be in, because the government will be so dispersed from that point thereon that they will not be able to marshal adequate defense. That's an interesting invitation. But there's no city in the United States equipped with air raid shelters. There's no city in the United States with food or medical supplies outside its city boundaries. There's no city in the United States which has sufficient hospital supplies to care for one-tenth of its population if they were all hit at the same time. And if the United States were to be hit in the dead of winter, 50% of its populace would die not of radiation but exposure. This is a fascinating view. A military government officer trained in World War II looks at this and he says, "What children are playing here? They must be kids." But it isn't the matter of that at all. It's a matter of an inability to confront the magnitude of disaster posed by an atomic weapon. And they can't confront that magnitude of disaster, so they are not aware of it, and they don't do anything about it at all. I'll tell you a juicy little item that just appeared in the papers here about 3 days ago. The Strategic Air Command, about which we have seen great, colossal Technicolor pictures, which has been played up as this terrific thing that is going to drop bombs on the enemy. It's right there. Boy, we'll retaliate. We'll show them if they drop bombs on us. That's the way we're defending the country. We'll threaten to blow them up. Of course, they're dealing with a suicidal enemy, and his entire intention would be to get blown up. But they disregard that. Do you know that Strategic Air Command has just, within the last 3 days, flown its first mission? It was in the papers the other day. B-52s can now fly 16,000 miles. Two B-52 planes have just flown 16,000 miles. It is not said how often they were refueled in the air, but they have just flown these missions. Oh, no. I don't know what sensor let this get through. But some War Department sensor was certainly, or Air Force sensor, was certainly sitting there with black goggles on. He's just said that although we have all these B-52s, we have no guarantee at all that they can take off from the United States and land in Russia without refueling. During an atomic war, I can imagine how easy this is. You see, you just send one of the B-52s out to the middle of the Atlantic with a cargo of fuel, and then you send another one 3/4 of the way to Russia with another cargo of fuel, and it waits there, you see. And then another B-52 gets over Moscow with a cargo of fuel, and it waits there. And then the B-52 carrying the bomb flies to the first one, refuels, second one refuels, third one refuels. And I'm sure they would consider this a practical plan, although they haven't considered how those three first B-52s ever get home. Now, that is the most marvelous view you ever saw. And yet, that is in a calm Air Force dispatch. It reads very nicely, and they're so proud that a B-52 has finally flown the Atlantic and come home again, only being refueled. Well, it didn't want to say how many times. It was at least twice. Now, there is defense. And I don't know who is supposed to be aware of these things, but has it ever occurred to you that maybe there's nobody supposed to be aware of them? Maybe this level of awareness is at a level that nobody notices it except people who are well-schooled into being aware. And that would only leave us guys. Well, that's a dismal view. I'm no hero. I expended all my heroism in the last war. Expended all of it trying to confront paymasters and so forth. I mean, look here. This is an interesting thing. We people in Dianetics and Scientology are aware of being aware and aware of the component parts of awareness. Well, this follows. It follows both ways. If you make somebody aware, then you can also make him confront. Although he might be very unhappy as he runs halfway through the engram, do you know that he's smarter and better off run halfway through birth and left than he was not to run it at all? Now, that is a fantastic fact, but is a matter of the most solemn and careful tests that these vicious things called engrams, as hard as they can bite. You run a fellow halfway through an automobile accident. He got through this automobile accident 3 months ago, and he's still gimping around, sort of crippled up, and you say, well, it's quite obvious that he's still stuck in that automobile accident. He has a mental image picture of it, and he's gotten into it, and somehow or other it's re-stimulated. But he's not aware of it, is he? Well, the funny part of it is he gets better if an auditor sits down and says, all right, start at the beginning of the accident and runs him halfway through up to the moment of the crash, pats him on the head, and walks off. Now, that is the subject of most exacting testing I ever want to supervise. I hate to sit down and test and test and test and find that a fact I won't believe persists in confronting me. You see, originally I misunderstood this. I thought that the fellow had to dive into an engram and go on through the engram and would be worse for a little while that he was going through the engramic experience and would then get better. But this did not prove to be the case on these tests. The way these tests were given might amuse you. I had to find in the first place some auditors that were sadistic enough and some pre-clears that were masochistic enough in order to conduct this series of experiments. An auditor's impulses are to make somebody better. And these auditors were being told and coached to make somebody much worse. And they firmly believed that they would be making somebody much worse if they conducted this experiment. The preclear was to be given, he was to be seated at a desk, and he was to be given one of these short form Otis tests. And he was to finish this test. And then the auditor was to run him halfway through any rough, vicious engram that the auditor could find. And park him, break the auditor's code, and shove the second test under his nose and make him do it. Now that was the procedure. And that was done very, very arduously. I finally found auditors that were sadistic enough and preclears that were masochistic enough in order to conduct this experiment. And having done so, I could not believe the results and had to run the experiment all over again. And I wouldn't believe those results and ran the experiment all over again. Because it said that somebody plunged into an engram and abandoned was better off than somebody who wasn't plunged into one. But it also said that somebody who was plunged into one and it was run out became much, much, much better. Don't you see? But the bettering process began at the moment I didn't think it would. Halfway through the roughest part of the engram and dropped. And people got better. That experiment was run 5 years ago. And it's only been recently that I've been able to patch together what happened. Well, what happened was that if you get somebody to confront something, he becomes aware of it. And a person who is aware of it is better off than the person who had it but wasn't aware of it. Don't you see? It is strictly a problem in awareness. And intelligence itself is a problem of awareness. And that's all there is to it. This isn't necessarily true that a person gets smarter because he's given a dreadful experience. Don't you see? That's different. He's smarter if he's given a dreadful experience and then it is attacked by Dianetic or Scientology techniques. Then he gets better. But because he finds out that he can confront such an experience secondhand through an engram, he discovers at the same time he needn't be quite so afraid of such experiences, and so he is willing to be more aware. And that is his IQ. That, to a large extent, is his profile, although other factors enter into a profile. All right, here then, we are confronted ourselves with this oddity that nobody is willing to look at the state of the world today. And it would be a very different thing for me in 1850. If this were 1850 right now here in Washington, I were telling you, the world is going to the dogs. It is going to the devil. Ladies and gentlemen, it cannot possibly survive. Well, you could listen to that. You say the man's an alarmist. Okay? Nothing to that. It's easy. But in 1950, it was not yet even visible to me that the cycle had already been entered. I already knew something was a bit awry and probably should be readjusted, but what else was discoverable? Well, in 1956, we take a look around and we find that there was a side effect going on all during these years, resulting from the explosion, test explosion only, as well as the wartime explosion, of atomic fission weapons, which was putting into the atmosphere unknown concentrations of deadly radiation. Now, they are guessing when they say how much radiation a person can stand. They do not know this fact. They haven't any clue. They do not know this. Modern science, as rough as it sometimes is, does not have the liberty of properly exposing people to this sort of thing and then observing them before and after. They are looking for, now this I could say about the whole subject, this will kill you, but but this is an amazing fact. The medicos, the pill boys, and the nuclear physicists, those people that are now drawing pay as nuclear physicists but graduated from English courses, believe alike that the upset is mainly due to and effective upon sexual activities and results. In other words, it's the sexual sector of life that they think atomic fission attacks. I think they've been reading too much Freud. They're afraid of mutation. Mutation has practically nothing to do with it. We don't care anything about this mutational angle. Good heavens, a man has to be shot to pieces with, I don't know, 15, 20, 30 Roentgen up close in order to have any mutational effect, and then it only lasts 5 or 6 days. Get that. It's one of these little mild effects. For only 5 or 6 days after exposure do they get two-headed babies. No, the effect is quite different. And they have not studied it at all. And yet it's right in their textbook, staring them right in the face. And I suppose it's too horrible for them to confront. Even though they have carefully recorded the physical manifestations of everybody exposed to radiation in Japan and so on, they don't confront their own figures. They don't become aware of them. People get sick. That is what happens. It isn't that their second dynamic goes adrift and they start producing rats or psychologists or something. That hasn't anything to do with it. That's somebody's morbid, I don't know where they got the boys that made these tests, but I have my suspicions. Hollywood, probably. But the main thing about it is people become ill. But before they become observably ill, a malaise sets in which is very detractive of their energies. Their ambition goes to pieces. Their ability to concentrate goes to pieces long before the medico would begin to detect it. If they were giving a series of tests of one kind or another to populace that has been closely subjected to atomic radiation, they would have found this to be the case. They wouldn't have left it up to us to discover this. They would have been honest enough to say so. But we have to believe that there are some honest men in the government. We have to believe this. I mean, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary. We have to believe that they actually do present you with what they find. We have to believe that the papers which they write on the subject are factual from their standpoint. It's just that they haven't observed it because they say these things all the time. They describe radiation sickness. Very cute. They describe radiation sickness. It says the onset is a lethargy. And this drifts on to an apathetic feeling. And this goes on to nausea, which is followed by colitis, or internal gastric upsets, which is followed by vomiting, which is followed by flushing or prickly sensations throughout the body. They describe all these things, and this is what radiation does to people, 1, 2, 3, 4, and yet at no time do they say in their medical reports that it does anything in the sphere of sex. It's just the people get sick. That's what the medical reports say, but all of the preventive measures which they take are totally aimed at sexual activity or results. Now, scientists usually aren't this bad off. We can only suppose that these boys have themselves been subjected to a bit of that lethargy and apathy. It must be, because they usually are not that inexact or unrealistic. For instance, the U.S. government's answer to the widespread radioactivity in the world today is to give everybody a tag which shows how many Roentgen he has been exposed to. And this would add up all of his X-rays and other radioactive exposures, and exposure from the atmosphere or by reason of bombs or manufacturers, and this would all be added up in terms of Roentgen. How many Roentgen, this unit of radiative unit, how many Roentgen has he been exposed to in his lifetime? And he'd then wear that tag. This is the official answer. He would then wear the tag, and any time he was given another X-ray, somebody would mark it on the tag and change his Roentgen rating. And they pick this number out of the air. They don't know where it came from, but it's 10 Roentgen. When he's been given 10 Roentgen, after that, his state of case becomes questionable. And his right to marry would thereafter be regulated by the government. Honest, no, that is not a dispatch from Pravda. That is a dispatch from Washington, D.C. Now, that is the government solution. But after people are exposed to 10 wrenching, this isn't a gag, by the way. This was on AP not very long ago. After people had been exposed to 10 wrenching, why, you'd have to be careful in permitting them to marry, and the government would have to take cognizance over their rights to marry. And after somebody had been exposed to so many, why, he's liable to have two-headed babies or psychologists or something, and so you'd have to forbid his marriage. That's the tack they're taking. It's totally unrealistic. Listen, if it gets that bad, there won't be anybody in the government physically well enough to sit still long enough to administer any kind of a test. They just discount this other factor. It makes people sick. That's what happens. Now, it's a very funny thing. As people become ill with atomic radiation, they become flighty. They become dispersive. They become a bit frantic. There's a period of franticness which is hit along the line, which is quite interesting. They will discard their possessions. I'm reading now out of the Japanese observation records following the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They become dispersive. They throw away their belongings. They abandon things. They neglect their duties and actions, and their level of responsibility drops to nothing. They avoid and desert their own families. It's quite interesting that the greatest civil defense regulations ever written on the face of earth appear in the Bible. If you care to read the Bible over carefully, you will find what I am talking about. There are certain civil defense regulations carefully listed in the Bible. There's another full set of physical preventatives, civil defense regulations, listed in another religion, the Brahmins. If you know anything about the Brahmins, each Brahmin sits by himself, cooks his own food, and nobody else must touch his food, he mustn't touch anybody else's food, and we've got all sorts of regulations that would apply at once only to a populace that had been knocked soggy with radiation. It's quite a curious thing. I'm not trying to be specific here at all in these. I'll look them up for you sometimes and tell you chapter and verse, but it's one of the more amusing things to look back into the past. To look back, by the way, at recent discoveries whereby they found 7 levels of civilization in the back of a cave, went straight back through, and then the last level had underlying it green glass. It's very possible. You see, an atomic bomb and exploding creates green glass. Now, it's very possible that all of this has happened before. But maybe there have been other scourges on Earth as great as radiation. So that we have such things as plagues and things which are a sufficiently overpowering magnitude so that they would put out a religion that they'd never explained to anybody. They just put out this religion to keep people alive. And the people who followed that religion lived through it. Now, let's say that Brahmanism wasn't caused by atomic fission, but maybe some plague of one kind or another that hit. And those that followed these directions with religious ferocity and stuck to them all the way through, they lived through it. And those who didn't, didn't. And so we would have the rise of Brahmanism. And these regulations, which you find Moses giving forth with and so forth, as such regulations as those are perhaps directed at prevention of some other human catastrophe, like, oh, I don't know, is prevention against pork and so on. Quite interestingly, it's merely leveled at trichinosis, a rather common disease. Maybe so many people got so sick from this that somebody had to put it into a religious code when it was actually hygiene. And maybe there have been before atomic attacks on Earth. Maybe. Who knows? But the facts of the case are these. That it requires a certain education of a populace if that populace is going to survive, regardless of whether or not you have a cure. You've got to educate people into something or other that will let them get through. You have to say, drinking water will be contaminated. You have to say, certain types of canned food will be edible and certain types will not be. Frozen food kept in such and such a way will be edible. They'd have to be educated into seeing the difference between radiation contamination and the usual ordinary scourge of disease that sweeps through a populace on the heels of any disaster. But that's an awful lot of educating. They can't even teach them the Bill of Rights, much less some of these measures which would have to be taken if a populace at this time and place would survive an atomic age. There are a lot of lessons that would have to be learned. What are these lessons? Well, we'd have to work them out somehow or another. How would you teach them? Well, that is not too difficult. Who should teach them? Well, who should teach them? Civil defense should teach them. That's who. But you keep handing them the hat. You say, look at this nice hat, nice brim. Nice label inside it. Now you put on that hat. That says civil defense. And that means the defense of the individual or collective public against public menaces, such as atomic war. Now go on, you wear that hat, and you do this, and you do that. And they say, it's not my hat. In the event of an atomic war, you're on your own. You just have to get used to the idea that nobody's going to do anything for you. You say, hey, you just threw that hat down here in the dust. Put that hat on. Nope. They say, it's not my size. Or they say, what hat? And that's really the case at this time. What hat? Is there anything going on? Is anything happening that has anything to do with radiation? You mean you're getting hysterical about the fact there may be a few two-headed babies in the world in the near future? Why, that's nonsense. Who cares? I mean, look at Eisenhower. No head. You could explain to them in vain. You could explain to them and say, people get sick. People become incapable of performing their routine duties when there's too much radiation in an atmosphere. And they get frantic, and they individuate. They fall away from one another. They will no longer work in groups. Now, I'm not here to tell you that the difficulties in the Middle East and in Hungary and so forth are incited or caused by the too high a radiation count in the atmosphere of the Middle East and Europe, but I will tell you that the count is there. It is already too high. I won't say that these nations and their alliances are falling apart simply along the traditional lines which follow exposure to radiation. I won't say that this spirit of war, this let's all fight, no, let's don't fight. We're at war with Syria and South Africa. No, that's wrong. Let's go to war with France and, the Hungarian troops are the ones today who are shooting down the Hungarians. Silly, but this is a fact. We don't care who ordered them to do it. They are Hungarian troops, not Soviet troops. Soviet troops are also doing it, but Hungarian troops are also shooting Hungarians. See, this is sort of a wild mix-up. There couldn't possibly be a war at this time, I figure, because nobody would be able to concentrate long enough on who he was mad at to fight him. By the time they'd called up the arms and ammunition and had informed the generals, which always takes some time, the war would have passed on that particular crisis and they'd be mad at somebody else. You see how this could be. And we have actually 6 or 7 factions now developing in the United Nations. It's so bad that I haven't heard it on the radio. First flashes came through and that was all. When last heard from, the United Nations were breaking up into about 16 different factions and parts, and then the morning newspapers carried nothing. I haven't seen the United Nations in the news since. This is a fascinating thing. We're not operating under censorship. Don't get that idea. It's just that the government won't let them print certain things. It's different. So anyhow, here we have this fantastic picture that maybe, and I only say maybe the world at this moment is sufficiently souped up with rentgen, with radiation, strontium-90, and the rest of it, that people are walking already at this first level of non-compass menace. Maybe they're walking in small circles. I wouldn't tell you for a moment that the United States State Department's apathy at this day and age is anything different than it used to be. But it might be worse. They used to put up ACT, and today they're not even putting up an ACT. Silliest program I ever saw was a TV program of the colleges of the northern coast of the United States questioning an assistant secretary of state concerning his policies. And man, I never heard a fellow let so many questions go by in my life. He didn't just let them go by. He stopped other questions. He just was not in the same conference. I don't know what conference he was attending, but I think it had something to do with whether or not they shouldn't get Dulles' Cadillac repaired. It certainly had nothing to do with the Middle East. I watched this and watched this state of not there-ness, of avoid, avoid, avoid. Don't make any direct statement. And that's what I see these days, is don't stop it. Don't stop the question. Don't confront the situation. And it all boils down to don't confront. Go to Atlanta. Go to Key West. Don't stay in. If anybody comes to see you, send them to an under clerk. That's the thing to do. Don't speak to him. That's dangerous. You get this funny manifestation that might be occurring. I don't say it's occurring at all. I make no claims on this. It's just a coincidence that all of a sudden we have a world situation which is different than any I have observed in my own current lifetime. And that is, we have people who are very anxious to go to war, but they can't find out with whom. And they're having an awful time here. And they can't even be consistent enough with their allies to count on having a good war, so they just keep quitting all the time. Now, what kind of an international situation is this? But a very confused one. We can't make head or tails out of this international situation. So I have decided, as my stable data in that confusion, that unless two fellows find out that they're mad at each other, they won't fight each other. See, they have to find who they're mad at in order to get a fight going. Now, it's true that if you get a fellow who is about to fight somebody and grab him suddenly by the arm, he's liable to swing at you. That's true. But he does it sort of half-heartedly, and he really doesn't put his whole heart into it. In order for there to be an international conflict, a couple of sides would have to line up. I don't think a war can exist with more than three sides fighting each other. There was such a war one time. We had one in this country. It was a triangular war. If you've ever read Midshipman Easy, you've read of the Great Triangular Duel, where the three midshipmen couldn't decide which one should have the shot at whom, and so on. So they stood in a triangle, and each one in turn shot at the other one. And came out wonderfully successful. Everybody's honor was... they had to argue one fellow into it, you see, because nobody was mad at him. He was just mad at other people. Now, there was a triangular war here in the United States one time. It's quite an amusing one. It had to do with the Gadsden's Purchase. You know the Gadsden Strip down there in Arizona? That after we stole California, Texas... Texans had already stolen Texas. And another large chunks of continent. Somebody got very moral and they bought something from Mexico. I think they paid cash for it. And that was the Gadsden Purchase. They wanted a railroad to go through there. But while that thing was going on, why, the Americans were fighting the Mexicans and the Indians down there were fighting both of them, and both of them were fighting the Indians. And you had a triangular war going on there for some little time. It was very funny. And finally, the motto got to be that if anybody put up his head, you shot at it. That was the way they got that war fought. It was quite an amazing war. Well, now, you could envision something developing out of this international situation whereby somebody would drop a bomb in the United States, the United States would drop a bomb on South Africa, and South Africa would bomb India, but we haven't got any planes that'll fly that far, they say now. And South Africa and India don't have any bombs. So it sort of falls apart on logic. I think everybody get tired and quit. That's the way it sums up to me. I think the amount of activity they enter upon will be less and less. That's at least my look at the situation. I haven't any idea what will happen to the radiation. If they laid off, if they stopped dropping bombs at this moment, no more test bombs, perhaps in many years you would get a settle out. It would go into seawater, or it would get embedded in the hills, and that would be the end of the fallout. I'd say perhaps within the rest of our lifetime, something like that. But the U.S. on its last few bombs has rather blasted that one, because they've now invented one that blows everything straight up into the super stratosphere where it won't come down for 10 years. They say that's the best thing to do. That's their new bomb. It blows all of its waste products straight up into the super stratosphere. And takes it 10 years to come down, they tell you. So my calculations on that went all to pieces. I went into apathy on that myself. Couldn't see any end to the fallout. But I say, perhaps in many years, why, if they stop dropping bombs, why, the fallout would fall out, and that would be the end of that. But doesn't seem like they're going to stop. In spite of all of the hue and cry and protest, Russia put up a big peace proposal and blew off a bomb the same day. I thought that was an interesting thing to do. They don't rattle sabers anymore. They rattle Geiger counters. So where we have these bombs being continually tested, if they continue with these tests, and Icky says they have to, I'm not quite sure why. I've been reading the newspapers, and I know they explode. I've been on the verge of writing him a letter and saying, Dear Ike, just for your information, several clippings are enclosed. The bomb does explode. It does explode. People set them off, and they do explode. And that's obviously the only thing you'd want to know is, do they explode? And they found that out, but of course his briefing secretaries haven't given him the word. He wasn't in the Oriental Theater, you know. He was over in Europe and so on. He didn't find out. Anyway, here's the crux of the situation. Somehow or another, somebody must put a curve on the communication lines to say, stop. Somebody saying you shouldn't go on testing bombs. That at least cuts out the increasing amount of count in the atmosphere. Now, who's going to do it? Well, who knows it? You got that? I mean, that has a lot to do with it. Who knows it? Well, Scientologists know it. But they're aware enough to be aware. And other people aren't aware enough to know that. So who are you going to tell it to? Well, Scientologists, of course. There's an amazing problem, you see. That's an amazing situation. We could look this thing over, and actually what I'm telling you now, I've heard you say here and there. You said, gee, you know, there's certainly not a lot of bombs going off. Sooner or later, somebody's going to get hurt. And all the time we were in Phoenix, why, the kids kept watching the reports on fallout, and they would be convulsed, not because of anything I said or anything else, but they were just convulsed at the government bulletins. The government bulletins read this way. There's no need to worry about the fallout. It is being carefully observed. And nobody in the government could see that this was a nonsensical statement. Who cares who's watching it? This lion that's running down the street, we're observing him carefully. What's the matter? Why are you worried? So, anyway, we have some inkling that something is going on in the world that's just a little bit different than it was before. We have in our graphs and the effectiveness of process and so forth certain records to this effect. We notice world behavior has altered to a marked degree. But our role has changed. It has changed definitely from a role of, well, let's just try to make people better and cut down the crime and, you know, help people out and pat them on the back. Our role has changed to something else. Our role might even have, it hasn't, but it might even have changed to simply a role of self-preservation as a group. See, it hasn't changed to that. But that would be the least to which it has changed. It certainly is true that a Scientologist has 5,000% better chance of surviving it than anybody else. See, that's true. All right, but that, of course, would not be the limit of it. What our role becomes is not a role of going around and waving invisible particles in people's faces, which they can't see anyhow. But our role would be in, one, trying to work out some sort of a regimen, a hygiene or health conduct, that people could follow without being aware of anything. See, that's the least we could do. And the next one would be to try to teach them some of the fundamentals of existence and at least get them aware of the fact that they're alive, and then maybe they will have some idea that they might continue to be alive. See, this would give them some impetus toward continuing to be alive. And at least we could do those things. Now, those are two there. Now, another thing that we could do that would be intensely practical and so on is talk. That doesn't sound practical. I mean, talk is just talk. But you see a lot of people. You see a lot of people. Well, there's no reason to tell them things that will simply worry them. But the only thing you could do is tell them there's some hope. Now, that we can always tell them. Somebody asked me one day, what is parascientology? Well, parascientology is your reality on Scientology. To a fellow that hears it for the first time, he now knows that there's a word Scientology, and that is Scientology, and everything else we know is parascientology. Got it? And then he knows that it offers some hope, so Scientology to him and the reality of it, the science itself, is just what he knows and no more, and that would be that there is a word Scientology and that it does offer some hope. See, now that's Scientology. Everything else we know is parascientology to him. And eventually he finds out that it'll turn off a toothache, big reality on something like that. So parascientology then is everything in Scientology except maybe the process that turned off the toothache, that it offers some hope, and there's a word called Scientology. You get the idea? So somewhere or another we have to enter this wedge. Eventually, a tremendous amount of our knowledge will become Scientology to him, and a very little of it will remain parascientology. And that is the way it works out. But now, here's something very odd. Here's something very peculiar. He doesn't start on that track at all, and his awareness is zero up to the moment when, right up to the instant, when he hears this word Scientology and that it offers some hope. See, it's about all you can really say to somebody. You can explain to him a lot of things, but he'll miss all these things. He'll eventually walk away from almost anything you tell him the first time, and he'll say, you know, there's something called Scientology. There must be, because this fellow's been talking about it. And it seems to offer some hope. He said it would work on my Aunt Agatha that I told him about. Yes, might offer some hope about Aunt Agatha. Probably won't do anything for her, but I could hope it would. Now, there's the entering wedge. Well, now there are numerous ways you could give people hope. Numerous ways. And one of them, you could say, you know this A-bomb thing? The fellow says, about the A-bomb thing and so on. You say, you know there's an outfit that's got this taped? Got it all squared? Who's that? Who's Scientology? He said, oh, it has. You get this as a very crude approach. He would then have the idea that there was somebody, someplace, that had some answers nailed down on this subject, you see? Now, that's very difficult to do and isn't very feasible because he doesn't know there's a subject called radiation. He just thinks there's new H-bombs and they're big TNT bombs, see, and that's all he knows about it. well-known scientists in the country today are not aware of these things, which is quite amazing. A teacher at Columbia University said, well, I needn't worry about it. When it comes, he said, it'll come with a big bang, and I'm all ready to get buried in a few years anyway. It doesn't matter whether I'm buried in a hole with the rest of the city or in a hole in a graveyard. He says, it's all the same to me. This guy was teaching college students at Columbia University. I said, what's your subject? And he says, chemistry. I said, chemistry. How? Oh, I see. And that's the way it is, huh? And he said, yeah, he says, doesn't matter really one way or the other, which happens. Now, does it? And I said, well, aside from the fact that you've got to come back and live it all over again, it doesn't matter a bit. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, it's like this. And I let him have it between the eyes. And shook him up enough and was sufficiently convincing enough so that he knew he'd been talking to somebody. And he wasn't at all sure that a hole in the city or a hole in the graveyard were comparable data. Well, that was a nasty thing for me to do. I did something I've told you time and again never to do. Don't back up parascientology to him. But let me excuse myself, that was in a period before people had a messianic complex, before people had the Messiah level. They're now only grabbing for crazy answers. One of the things you could do is pose as a crazy answer. You're the only sane answer there is. You get that? People who are not aware of something yet are surrounded by it only grab crazy answers. So give it to them. I found out it works. So tonight, I would like to pull the wraps off, whole track, exteriorization, and all the other bric-a-brac that you shouldn't talk about. Because the society has finally gotten into a state of mind where it will only believe what it thinks is crazy. And it thinks this is crazy, and so it'll believe it. Remember, the last full page I had in Time magazine was because I was telling people they were 76 trillion years old. That's the last full page. It's been mentioned since, but not a full page. So I'm publishing in hard covers now, History of Man, known better to you as What to Audit.